Chapter 6. The CIA. On May 24, 1979, a 14-foot bronze statue of General William J. Donovan was dedicated in front of Columbia University's law school. The dedication speech was delivered by John J. McCloy, who had been Assistant Secretary of War when Donovan founded the Office of Strategic Services in World War II. When Donovan died on February 8, 1959, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Alan W. Dulles, sent a message to all CIA stations around the world. Bill Donovan was the father of Central Intelligence. He was a great leader. International Intelligence, or, as it was formerly known, espionage, was not founded by either Donovan or Dulles, who were merely employees of the World Order. The Order founded international espionage to protect their far-reaching investments and dealings in slaves, drugs and gold, the commodities on which their wealth was built. On November 17, 1843, the port of Shanghai was opened to foreign traders. Lot number 1 was rented by Jardine Matheson and Company. Other entrepreneurs were Dent and Company, and Samuel Russell, an American who represented Baring Brothers. Captain Warren Delano, Franklin D. Roosevelt's grandfather, became a charter member of the Canton Regatta Club, and entered into dealings with the Hong Society. Dr. Emmanuel Josephson states, Warren Delano, Frederick A. Delano's father, founded his fortune on smuggling opium into China. His son, Frederick A. Delano, was born in Hong Kong, and later became the first vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board in 1914. Although he was the son of an Irish ward healer, William J. Donovan studied law at Columbia from 1903 to 1908. His grades were said to be atrocious, but one of his professors, Harlan F. Stone, took a liking to him. Another protege of Stone was J. Edgar Hoover. As 132, Attorney General Stone shocked Washington by naming Hoover director of the Bureau of Investigation. Another Columbia professor who liked Donovan was Jackson E. Reynolds, later president of the First National Bank of New York, who backed Donovan's selection as head of US. One of Donovan's Columbia classmates was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1910, Donovan met Eleanor Robson, an actress who later married August Belmont, American representative of the Rothschilds. There was no question of their marriage. He was looking for a rich wife, she was looking for a rich husband. They began a relationship which lasted 4 years. Donovan also courted Blanche Lopez, of a wealthy tobacco family, who lived in Rumson, New Jersey. He then returned to Buffalo, where he opened a law practice. He met Ruth Rumsey, and abruptly dropped Blanche Lopez, never contacting her again. Ruth Rumsey was heiress of one of the richest families in America. Her father, Dexter Rumsey, and her uncle Bronson owned 22 of Buffalo 43 square miles. In 1890, Dexter Rumsey was worth $1 million. His wife was a member of the wealthy Hazard family of Rhode Island, who had owned 1,000 slaves, and were the largest slave owners in America. The Rumseys were masters of the Genesee Valley Hunt, the most exclusive hunt club in the U.S. Dexter Rumsey died in 1906, leaving his son and daughter 121 over 2% each of his fortune in trust. Bill Donovan's courtship of Ruth Rumsey was complicated by the reappearance in Buffalo of Eleanor Robson, now Mrs. August Belmont. She turned up at the Studio Club, an acting group run by Catherine Cornell's father, where Donovan had the juvenile lead. La Robson requested that Donovan come to her suite in New York each weekend for drama lessons. Donovan then took the long train ride to New York City each weekend, causing considerable gossip in Buffalo, where he was already widely known for his philandering. Nevertheless, Ruth Rumsey had determined to marry him, probably because her family was so strongly opposed. Friends of the family stated that had Dexter Rumsey lived, he would never have allowed this marriage to take place, because of Donovan's age, he was 3'1", his religion, Irish Catholic, and his philandering. The Rumseys were Episcopalian, but Donovan persuaded his wife to bring up their 133 children as Roman Catholics. His brother was a priest. After the marriage, Donovan and his wife moved into the Rumsey family mansion at 742 Delaware Avenue in Buffalo. Because of his New York connections, the Rockefeller Foundation selected Donovan to go to Europe on a war relief mission in 1915, the first of many assignments from the World Order. He was to be separated from Ruth Donovan continually during the next 3 years. While in London, he worked with Ambassador Walter Nelson Page, William Stevenson, who later advised him on setting up the US, and Herbert Hoover. Donovan spent 5 weeks in Belgium, as an observer with Hoover's Belgian Relief Commission. When the U.S. entered World War I, Donovan helped organize the Rainbow Division, and was given command of the Fighting 69th. He fought at Lens at Lens St. George, in the Meuse-Argonne sector, where, although wounded, he charged a German machine gun squad on October 1, 5, 1918 with his bayonet. For this feat, he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. His bravery was the subject of wide publicity in the American press, and Current Biography later stated he was the most famous man in the AEF. He was with Joyce Kilmer, the poet, when Kilmer was shot down. In 1919 and 1920, Donovan was sent on secret missions to China and Siberia. After the war, J.P. Morgan established the Foreign Commercial Corporation to float $2 billion in bonds in post-war Europe. In February 1920, he asked Donovan to make a secret tour of Europe to obtain intelligence relating to these bonds. Cave Brown described this mission: having helped to finance the war, Morgan wished to help finance the peace by expanding the House of Morgan's interests widely. These activities required the best intelligence from the best sources in Europe. Point Donovan and the Rainbow Division intelligence officer, Grayson Mallet Brave O'Murphy, had been retained by John Lord O'Brien's firm to obtain that intelligence, working in secrecy. Morgan reportedly paid Donovan $200,000 for this operation. 134. During his European reconnaissance, Donovan met Adolf Hitler at Berchtesgaden, and spent an evening with him in his room at Pension Moritz. Donovan later claimed he had not known who Hitler was, but that he found him a fascinating talker. In 1922, Donovan was appointed U.S. District Attorney for New York. In 1924, Attorney General Harlan F. Stone, Donovan's Columbia Law professor, asked him to come to Washington, as Astepe General Donovan and his wife bought a house in Georgetown, later the home of Catherine Meyer, at 1-637-30th St. Donovan's first official act was to demand that Stone fire J. Edgar Hoover from the Bureau of Investigation. Instead, Stone, who was Hoover's patron as well as Donovan's, appointed Hoover director of the Bureau of Investigation Dec. 18,1924. Donovan also became involved in another political football, the prosecution of Senator Burton K. Wheeler. Wheeler was defended by Senator Tom Walsh, one of the most powerful politicians in Washington, but Donovan, against all advice to the contrary, insisted on proceeding with the prosecution. It was said that the charges against Wheeler were ludicrous, and Stone asked Donovan to drop the case, but he stubbornly proceeded to indict Wheeler before a District of Columbia grand jury. When the case was tried in Great Falls, the jury deliberated only 10 minutes before bringing in a verdict of acquittal for Wheeler. Such a boner would have destroyed the careers of most men in Washington, but Donovan was under the protection of Herbert Hoover, his associate from World War I between 1924 and 1928. He was Hoover's closest associate. Hoover took him to the Bohemian Club, the sacrosanct West Coast powerhouse, where he was the directing figure. Hoover then persuaded President Coolidge to appoint Donovan to the Colorado River Commission, a seven-state authority which organized the proposals for the Hoover Dam, later renamed the Boulder Dam by FDR, and still later, renamed the Hoover Dam by Act of Congress in 1947. During the 1920s, Republican politicians favored the nomination of Dawes for president. Although it seemed that he was backing a sure loser, Donovan worked as Hoover's top strategist for 4 years. When Hoover was nominated on the 135 ballot at the Republican convention, a tribute to the power of the Rothschilds, Donovan wrote his acceptance speech. It was understood that Donovan was to be Hoover's running mate. However, Hoover immediately realized that, because he was running against Al Smith, a Roman Catholic, he would lose the massive anti-Catholic vote if he picked Donovan, also a Roman Catholic, as his running mate. Hoover had no intention of losing his trump card in the forthcoming election. He cast Donovan aside without a second thought, and even refused to consider him for a cabinet post, such as Attorney General, probably the only time in American politics that the architect of a successful presidential campaign was denied a position on the team or in the cabinet. The disheartened Donovan decided to forego political life. In 1929, he organized the law firm of Donovan, Leisure, Newton & Irvine, with offices at 2 Wall Street. He also took a 23-room suite at the Shoreham Hotel for the firm's Washington offices. During ensuing years, Donovan rarely saw his wife, although they were never legally separated. DeLocca's biography of Donovan notes that he always had his pick of feminine admirers. To many of the women he met, Donovan was irresistible. Ruth Donovan stayed at their summer home on the South Shore of Massachusetts, or at their New York apartment on Beekman Place. Despite his disappointment with Hoover, Donovan continued to take an active role in national politics. He ran Knox's campaign for the Republican nomination in 1936, and his firm defended American Telephone and Telegraph in an antitrust suit by the government. Donovan won handily, which brought in a new influx of business to his firm. In 1937, Donovan renewed his association with the Rothschilds. The Viennese branch of the family had lost extensive holdings in Bohemia when the Nazis moved into Czechoslovakia. Because Donovan had already established a network of informants in the highest echelons of the Nazi government, including Admiral Canaris, the Rothschilds asked him to salvage their interests. He went to 136 Germany to argue their case, but despite his important contacts, he was defeated by Hitler's view of the Rothschilds as a symbol of what he hoped to achieve in his battle against the international bankers. The Rothschilds were not overly concerned. They knew that World War II was on its way, and that the outcome had been decided in advance. Donovan won another important legal victory in 1937, when he and a staff of 57 lawyers defended his oil firms against antitrust charges. His clients were let off with nominal fines, and once again Donovan was considered the winner. His German contacts now invited him to observe the Nuremberg maneuvers as a guest of the German general staff. He also accompanied them on a trip to observe the progress of the Spanish Civil War. Although he was there as an invited guest of the fascists, Donovan was soon to build the us around the hardcore of the communist Lincoln Brigade. He met Kim Philby in Spain, who was writing about the Civil War as a pro-Nazi journalist, a pose he carried off successfully despite Hayek's recent marriage to Lizzi Friedman, a fanatical communist and Zionist provocateur. On April 10, 1940, Donovan's daughter, Patricia wrecked her car near Fredericksburg, Virginia, and was killed. She was his only daughter. There was also one son, David, who married Mary Grandin, Patricia's roommate at boarding school, and heiress of a wealthy Philadelphia family. Associates said that Donovan never got over his daughter's death. Because he had received the Congressional Medal of Honor, Patricia was buried in Arlington National Cemetery. His grief-stricken wife left for a round-the-world cruise on Irving Johnson's ship, Yankee. On May 29, William Stevenson arrived in New York with a letter to Donovan from Admiral Blinker Hall, a British naval intelligence officer whom Donovan had met in 1916. The letter proposed an American intelligence agency, although we were not at war. Franklin D. Roosevelt sent Donovan to London with orders to 137. Develop this program as an unofficial observer. Despite efforts at secrecy, there was widespread journalistic speculation about his mission for Roosevelt. He then made a tour of Southeast Europe for the president, gauging the status of the German-occupied countries. Although this was an obvious espionage mission, the Germans placed new obstacles in his path. They were anxious to maintain good relations with the United States. After Donovan delivered his report to the president, he was named coordinator of information by the White House. Because he had had no experience in propaganda work, the office was later split into the Office of War Information, Executive Order 9128, and the Office of Strategic Services, Military Order of June 13, 1942. Donovan was placed in charge of the US. The new agency was from the outset merely an outpost of British intelligence. On September 18, Colonel E.I. Jacob, Churchill's military secretary, was informed by Major Desmond Morden Church, Churchill's liaison with the British Secret Service. Another most secret fact of which the Prime Minister is aware is that to all intents and purposes U.S. security is being run for them at the President's request by the British. A British officer sits in Washington with Mr. Edgar Hoover and General Bill Donovan for this purpose. It is of course essential that this fact should not be known. For some months, Donovan had been living in a suite at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. He and William Stevenson had been meeting regularly since 1940 to organize the new agency. Stevenson was working directly under Colonel Stuart Menzies, head of Special Operations Executive, the top British intelligence agency. As cover, Menzies was colonel in the Life Guards, the escort troop of the King. Stevenson was head of SIS, Special Intelligence Section. When Donovan had left for London July 15th, on his mission for Roosevelt, Stevenson had wired London, Colonel W.M.J. Donovan, personally representing the President, left yesterday by Clipper. U.S. Embassy not repeat not being informed. 138. This was a replay of the House Wilson-Wiseman operation during World War I. Not only were the American people left in the dark, but concerned agencies were never told what the conspirators had planned. Donovan's London mission was a slap in the face to the U.S. Ambassador, Joseph Kennedy. Roosevelt called Donovan my secret legs, and he assured Stevenson in a private interview, "I'm your biggest undercover agent." In A Man Called Intrepid, Stevenson is quoted as saying that after April 1939, the president was one of us. It was also in 1939 that Roosevelt privately told Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada and a longtime Rockefeller agent, "Our frontier is on the Rhine." This same book quotes Churchill as saying, "On the eve of war, we need Rockefeller and Rothschild." Stevenson replied, "I can find the Rockefellers and they'll support us. We can offer our secret intelligence in return for help." Indeed, the Rockefellers gave Stevenson an entire floor rent-free at Rockefeller Center, where the agency has operated ever since. A later book, Intrepid S. Last Case, notes that what some would later call the secret CIS secret occupation of Manhattan began in 1940. By 1941, J. Edgar Hoover was complaining that the Rockefeller Center headquarters of British Security Coordination controlled an army of British secret agents, a group of 9 distinct secret agencies. Attorney General Biddle was quoted as saying, "The truth is nobody knows anything about what Stevenson does." Had anyone known, Stevenson would have had to be arrested and deported. German sailors were being deliberately murdered by Stevenson's provocateurs in New York, as acts designed to force Hitler to declare war against the United States. The Intrepid file in So, Stevenson's cover name, described it as a reign of terror conducted by specially trained agents and fortified by espionage and intelligence in occupied Europe. Every act of Donovan and Stevenson was a violation of American neutrality. Donovan's law office at 2 Wall Street was next to the passport control office. He had special passports prepared for Stevenson's British agents. Stevenson. 139. Had offices at 3 locations, Hampshire House, Dorset Hotel, and Rockefeller Center. Alan Dulles had opened a branch office of Coordinator of Information at Rockefeller Center in 1940. He evicted all the tenants on the 25th floor of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, which was the floor above the UK Commercial Corporation, whose president was William Stevenson. This agency was set up after Stevenson complained on April 14, 1941 that Standard Oil was supplying the Germans through Spain, and that it was acting as a hostile and dangerous agency of the enemy. A 400-page report by Stevenson listing Standard Oil and other American corporations' dealings with the Germans was turned over to the FBI in 1941. J. Edgar Hoover prudently buried it. Nelson Rockefeller, as coordinator of inter-American affairs, covered up the supplying of German military forces from his South American subsidiaries. Listed in the Stevenson report were Standard Oil I.G. Farben, a subsidiary of Standard Oil, Ford Motor Company, Bayer Aspirin, Sterling Drug, General Aniline and Film, ANSCO, and International Telephone and Telegraph Company. Sosthenes Ben, head of it, had hosted a lavish conference of German intelligence operatives at the Waldorf Astoria in 1940. The German director of it was Baron Kurt von Schroeder, of the Schroeder banking family of Cologne, London and New York, who was Hitler's personal banker. The OSS was actually set up by 4 members of the British Chief of Staff, Lord Louis Mountbatten, formerly Battenberg, a cousin of the King, and related to the Frankfurt banking families, Rothschild and Castle, Charles Hambrough, Director of Special Operations Executive, and Director of Hambrough's Bank, Colonel Stuart Menzies, head of Secret Intelligence Service, and William Stevenson, in charge of CIS American operations. An ancestor of Colonel Menzies had been a notorious Jacobite double agent during the last days of James Ike's reign. The present Menzies was the son of Lady Halford. He married Lady Sackville, daughter of the 8th Earl de La Moore, of the Sackville West family which owned historic Knoll. Second, he married Pamela Beckett, daughter of J. Rupert Beckett, CHMN of Westminster Bank, now National Westminster Bank, one of England's Big Five. Menzies. 140. Mother-in-law was the daughter of Lord Berkeley Paget, Marquess of Anglesey. Menzies' daughter married Lord Edward Hay, Marquess of Tweedsdale, Earl of Kinnoll, related to Countess of Errol. The present Sir Peter Menzies is a director of National Westminster Bank, treasurer of the giant Imperial Chemical Industries, and director of Commercial Union Assurance Company. In the British Who's Who, 1950, Colonel Menzies noted that he had been appointed C. head of MI6 from 193951, but in later editions, he omitted this information. Ford states in his acknowledgments, Lord Mountbatten of Burma was a close personal friend of Donovan, as one of the four members of the British Chief of Staff Committee which helped Donovan in the formation and operation of Office of Strategic Services. The American Secret Service was never anything but a British operation, directed at all levels by representatives of the British Crown. US agents received advanced training for the European Theatre at Bletchley Park, British espionage headquarters. This site was chosen because it was only 10 miles from Woburn Abbey, where Lord Beaverbrook's agent, Sefton Delmer, operated the British Dirty Tricks Centre and other propaganda activities. Woburn Abbey was the ancestral home of the Duke of Bedford, Marquess of Tavistock. The British Bureau of Psychological Warfare operated as the Tavistock Institute. The membership list of CFR members in 1946 reveals the names of many US and OUI operatives. Lyman Bryson, who was with the American Red Cross in Paris, 1918-19, Chief of Special Operations, OUI, 1942, and a director of CBS, Thomas W. Childs, Rhodes Scholar, Paris representative of Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Law Firm, executive. Assistant to British Butte, War Supply U.S., British Embassy, Washington, 1942-45, Partner Lazard Freers 1945-48, holds Order of the British Empire, Leader in English-Speaking Union, Nicholas Roosevelt, American Commission to Negotiate Peace, Paris, 1919, OUI, 1942-43, Joseph Barnes, Director OWLS Foreign Operations, organized Wilkie's World Tour 1942, coined Thefrace One World. 141. Identified as a communist agent, Elmo Roper, the famed pollster, US agent 1942-45, Gaudens Megaro, Chief Italian Section US 194-1-45, Henry Sturgis Morgan, son of J.P. Morgan, Director Pullman, General Electric, Shepard Morgan, London Director US 1943-44, was with Federal Reserve Bank of New York 1916-24, Director Reparations Payments Berlin 1-92430 supervised by Chase Nattel Bank, later CHMN Nattel Bureau of Economic Research, the Rockefeller Propaganda Operation, John Gardner, US Europe 1944-45, then joined the Carnegie Corporation, Alan W. Dulles Chief US Europe, Director J. Henry Schroeder, later First Director CIA, John Haskell, US 1943-44, formerly with Nattel City Company 192531. Another son of J.P. Morgan, Junius, was placed in charge of US finances. Paul Mellon and his brother-in-law, David Bruce joined US. Bruce was in charge of the London office. Latour was ambassador to France. US also had operatives from the Vanderbilt, Archbold, DuPont and Rhine families, giving rise to the quip that US meant oh so social. James Paul Warburg, son of Paul who had written the Federal Reserve Act, was Donovan's personal assistant in setting up US. William J. Casey, present head of CIA, was chief of Secret Intelligence US Europe. In February 1981, US veterans held a gala reunion in New York. Present were Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of England, Julia Child, Beverly Widner, Hollywood designer, John Shaheen, who had been chief of US Special Projects now wealthy oil man, Ernest Cunha, who had been liaison son between US and FDR, Arthur Goldberg, labor lawyer and Zionist leader, later Supreme Court Justice and U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Bill Colby, later chief of CIA, and Temple Fielding, the travel authority who began his travel expertise with us. One of us most famous agents who didn't show up was Ho Chi Minh. Us agents became prominent members of the new class in Washington. Archibald MacLeish became Librarian of Congress. Ralph Bunche became U.S. Representative to the U.N.S. Dillon Ripley became head of the Smithsonian. 142. Donovan had been chosen to head the US because of 2 decades in which he carried out secret missions for the Morgans, the Rockefellers, and the Rothschilds. When he staffed the agency with known communists, they offered no objection. He had earlier provided unpaid legal help for members of the Communist Mercenary Force, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Now he welcomed these veteran anti-fascists into US. Ford writes, in the US employment of pro-communists was approved at very high levels. US often welcomed the services of Marxist enthusiasts. When J. Edgar Hoover, eager to embarrass a rival, sent agents to Donovan with FBI dossiers on communist US employees, Donovan replied, I know they're communists, that's why I hired them. Donovan loaded US with such fanatical communists that they became a joke in Washington. He appointed Dr. Morris Halper in chief Latin American dividend US. Halperin regularly altered the information which came across his desk to fit the current party line. He often kept his office locked, causing other US employees to joke that Halperin must be having another cell meeting. After the war, J. Edgar Hoover testified before Congress about Halperin quote's communist background. Halperin later moved to Moscow, then to Havana. Despite the damning dossiers which J. Edgar Hoover maintained on leading communists in the US, he could find no politician willing to buck FDR's 3 White House assistants, Hiss, Curry, and White. Eleanor Roosevelt had been one of the most frenetic activists on behalf of the Lincoln Brigade. Joe Lash gave her a small bronze of a communist soldier, which she kept on her desk for the rest of her life. Donovan even appointed Irving Goff head of US in Italy, after the Salerno landing. Goff had been commander of the Lincoln Brigade, and was later chairman of the Communist Party in Louisiana and New York. The Spanish Civil War had created an alliance between American intellectuals and the communists. In Passionate Years, Peter Wyden reports that archivist Victor A. Birch, of Brandeis University, said 40% of the Lincoln Brigade were Jewish. Oddly enough, the 143 Fascists, the Falange, was led by 2 Marinists, General Franco and his financial backer, Juan March. March paid for Franco's return to Spain with a $2 million credit at Klein Ward S of London. In July 1936, March placed $82 million of securities in nationalist accounts. He deposited $1.5 billion in gold at the Bank of Italy, 121.5 metric tons greater than the gold reserve of most nations. The communists stole the Spanish gold reserve and shipped it to Russia. NKVD General Alexander Orlov, on orders from Ivan Vasilovich, a rare code name for Stalin, loaded Spain's gold reserve on the Soviet ship Komsomol October 25. It arrived in Odessa November 2, and was trucked to Moscow's precious metals deposit, Gokhran, $788 million. $240 million had also been shipped to France from Spain. The Lincoln volunteers surrendered their passports to NKVD officers when they arrived in Spain. These passports were then routinely used in communist espionage. The murderer of Trotsky was arrested in Mexico with a Canadian passport issued to Tony Babich, who was killed in the Civil War. Gauzenko later exposed a communist agent in Los Angeles using the passport of Ignacy Witczak. Witnesses saw stacks of these Lincoln passports stacked in the Lubyanka prison, waiting to be used. Ernest Hemingway wrote that the Spanish Civil War was the happiest time of our lives. He modeled his hero in For Whom the Bell Tolls on Robert Merriman, a Moscow agent who was receiving a $900 a year fellowship from the University of California. Hemingway wrote and produced a film, The Spanish Earth, to raise money for the communists, aided by Archibald MacLeish, Dashiell Hammett and Lillian Hellman. Hemingway put up $2,750 for the film, and donated all his royalties. He toured Hollywood to raise funds for the communists, an effort reciprocated, when they named his book For Whom the Bell Tolls a Book of the Month Club selection and a multi-million-dollar Hollywood production. This was how one achieved artistic success in the 1940s. 144. The English contingent fighting in Spain for the communists included Virginia Woolf's nephew, Julian Bell, who was killed, and Eric Blair, later known as George Orwell. He was in the front line for 112 days before being wounded. He later wrote 1984 propaganda coup for the world order, which claimed no one would be able to withstand their power. He concluded 1984 with the observation that the future would be marked by jackboots being stamped into the human face forever. Journalists to a man rallied to the communist cause. A.M. Rosenthal, executive editor of the New York Times, said of his brother-in-law, George Watt, commissar of the Lincoln Battalion, "God, how I admired that man. He was my hero." Herbert L. Matthews wrote in 1946, "Nothing so wonderful will ever happen to me again as those 2.5 years I spent in Spain. There I learned that men could be brothers." Today, wherever in this world I meet a man or woman who fought for Spanish liberty, I meet a kindred soul. Nothing will ever break that bond. We left our hearts there. Despite his despair, Matthews was able to relieve the glory of Spanish years when he promoted Castro and a band of 6 guerrillas into the dictatorship of Cuba through a frenetic propaganda barrage in the New York Times. Kim Philby, later active with the US and CIA, as British liaison, also was prominent in the Spanish Civil War. Son of the famed Arabist, Sir Harold Philby, he joined the Cambridge Socialist Society in 1929. He worked for the British Treasury 1932-33 and was recruited by the Communist Party. In 1934, in Vienna, he married Lizzy Friedman, a communist agent. Witness at the marriage was Teddy Kollek, later a fundraiser for the Israeli terrorists, now mayor of Tel Aviv. Working as a Soviet mole, Philby was financed by the Schroeder Bank in 1934 to publish a pro-Hitler magazine for the Anglo-German Fellowship. The Times then sent him to Spain to cover the Civil War. Hitakish's mistress the divorced with the officer Anthony Lindsay Ho G.G. Francis Doble, a Falangist sympathizer who Salaman Capellas. 145. Became his Spanish headquarters. The daughter of a Canadian banker, Doble lavishly entertained the Falangist leaders. Philby frequently met General Franco there. Philby was recruited for the British CIS in 1940. In 1942, he helped Norman Holmes Pearson, a Yale professor who specialized in the work of Ezra Pound, to set up the London office of US with Charles Hambro, chief of SO. In 1949, Philby was sent to Washington as CIS liaison officer with the CIA and FBI. J. Edgar Hoover frequently lunched at Harvey's restaurant with Philby and James Angleton of the CIA. While CIA station chief in Rome, Angleton worked closely with the Zionist terrorists Teddy Kollek and Jacob Meritor, and later became chief of the Israeli desk at the CIA, helping Philby to set up the lavishly funded international Mossad espionage operation, all paid for by American taxpayers. A senior CIA security official, C. Edward Petty, later reported that Angleton might be a Soviet penetration agent or mole, but President Gerald Ford suppressed the report. Top secret files of the CIA and FBI were opened to Philby, despite widespread claims that he was a Soviet agent. Although he helped Burgess and McLean defect to Russia in 1951, he continued to work for CIS until 1956, under the protection of Harold Macmillan, who defended him publicly in parliamentary debate. In 1962, an English woman at a party in Israel said, "As usual, Kim is doing what his Russian control tells him. I know that he always worked for the Reds." Miles Copeland says that Philby placed a mole in deep cover in the CIA known as Mother. Philby was quoted as saying, "Foreign agencies spying on the US government know exactly what one person in the CIA wants them to know, no more and no less." Philby was finally exposed by a defector, Michael Belinewski. On January 23, 1963, Philby left Beirut and defected to Moscow, where he became a lieutenant general in the KGB. On June 10, Tadz Zolk wrote in the Washington Post that Philby was never a Soviet agent, according to CIA memoranda introduced in a lawsuit, but that he was a triple agent. This explains curious paradoxes in the supposed rivalry between the CIA and the KGB when certain charmed souls float easily back and forth between the two services. Point agent Sophie for service are eliminated. 146. When they find out more than is good for them about this odd arrangement. Intrepid S. Last case states that for 38 years there was an official in KVD mission in London whose agents were assisted by both British Special Operations and the American US. Only now is it clear that Moscow had received hundreds of top secret US research studies and that the British had supplied guerrilla warfare expertise to the chief of the NKVD's subversive operations, called A.P. Osikov. In 1943, Donovan was sent on a special mission to Moscow to establish a permanent alliance between the US and the NKVD. Donovan, W. Averell Harriman, and Lieutenant General Finn and Major Gen.P. Osikov of the NKVD worked out a plan to establish offices of the NKVD in key American cities. On February 1, 0,1944, J. Edgar Hoover sent a confidential message to Harry Hopkins, "I have just learned from a confidential source that a liaison arrangement has been perfected between the US and the NKVD whereby officers will be exchanged between the services. The NKVD will set up an office in Washington." Hopkins was forced to contact E.General Biddle to alert the Department of Justice to this operation. Because of the coming election, Roosevelt prudently withdrew his support for the plan. Because of their cooperation with the NKVD and the prominent communists in US, General Douglas MacArthur refused to allow any US agent in his theater of operations in the Pacific. Donovan went to MacArthur's headquarters on April 2, 1944 and made a personal appeal to him, but was rebuffed. MacArthur considered the US agents more dangerous to American security than any military opponents. In Donovan's Washington headquarters, Estelle Frankfurter was caught stealing confidential US reports. She was discharged, although her brother, Justice Felix Frankfurter, was Roosevelt's closest confidant. As organizer of the Herald Wire cell, Frankfurter had placed Soviet operatives in many government agencies, and had put his personal protege, Alger Hiss, in FDR's office. Frankfurter's brother, Otto, served a sentence in Anamosa State Prison, Iowa for fraud. 147. While Joseph E. Davies was ambassador to Moscow, the State Department in 1937-38 was ordered to destroy all of its irreplaceable files on the Soviet Union. The Russian division of the State Department was abolished, and the last anti-communist survivors were summarily fired. Since 1935, seven Soviet networks of espionage had been active throughout Europe. Known by their German name, Die Rote Kapelle, the Red Orchestra, they were run by Grand Chief Leopold Trepper, who later immigrated to Israel. In January 1942, Alan Dulles enlisted Die Rote Kapelle to form an anti-German group led by Baron Wolfgang von Pultitz, who later arranged for the defection to East Germany of Otto John, head of West Germany's FBI. During World War II, both von Pultitz and John had worked under Charles Hambro at Britain's SOA. General Alfred E. Wedemeyer later testified that in 1942 he had proposed a guaranteed plan to shorten the war by at least a year, invading France across the Channel. Winston Churchill argued for his soft underbelly approach through North Africa and Sicily. General Marshall called Wedemeyer before Churchill and Roosevelt to explain his plan, on which he had worked for months, perfecting every detail. Churchill persuaded Roosevelt to postpone the Wedemeyer plan for another year, while the Churchill plan was put into action in North Africa in November 1942. Wedemeyer's plan was vindicated in 1946 by General Franz Haider, Chief of Staff of the German Army, who said the Wedemeyer cross-channel invasion would have been a decisive and timely blow which would have shortened the war by at least a year. However, ending the war in 1943 would have cost the munitions manufacturers many billions in profits. Ezra Pound broadcast on July 7, 1943. "I reckon my last talk was the most courageous I have ever given. I was playing with fire. I was openly talking about how the war may be prolonged by fellows who were scared that the war might stop. I mean they're scared right out of their little gray panties, for fear economic equity might set in as soon as guns stop shooting or shortly thereafter." The stage scenery fell with a flop, simultaneously with some anti-Axis successes. What was Pound talking about? Stage scenery, what a cynical way to describe a world conflagration in which 100 million people were dying. Pound exposed the charade. Early in the war, a British Secret Service operation, Operation Ultra, had obtained the German coding machine. They were able to read every secret order from Hitler and the German General Staff. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. F.W. Winterbotham, chief of Air Intelligence, CIS, wrote about his operation of Ultra, the Ultra Secret. He says, on August 2, 1944, which I remember, covered two whole sheets of my Ultra paper, Hitler told Kluge not to pay any attention to the American breakout. He then outlined his master plan for handling the entire invasion. Had Hitler had access to all secret communications of the Allies, he would have had an unbeatable advantage. The Allies listened to all of his orders, and reacted accordingly. Early in the war, Ultra informed them that the Germans were planning a massive bombing raid on Coventry. If they evacuated the city, it would show the Germans they were listening to their plans. Churchill ordered the British to do nothing. The Germans bombed Coventry, killing thousands of women and children. The Ultra Secret was protected at the cost of many British lives. The British also had a double agent, Baron Wilhelm de Rupp, who was Hitler's personal confidant on British policy. De Rupp had lived in England since 1910. He married an Anglo-SH wife, but maintained an apartment on the Kurfürstendamm, as a journalist moving between Germany and England. His closest friend in England was F. W. Winterbotham, chief of Air Intelligence. In February 1, 1934, de Rupp took Winterbotham to Germany, where he conferred with Hitler, Rudolf Hess, and von Milch, head of the German Air Force. Winterbotham writes, by 1934, one had obtained personal contact with the head of state, Hitler, and with Alfred Rosenberg, the official Nationalist Party philosopher and foreign affairs expert, and Rudolf Hess, Hitler's 149. Deputy. From my personal meetings with Hitler, I learned about his basic belief that the only hope for an ordered world was that it should be ruled by three superior powers, the British Empire, the Greater Americas, and the New Greater Reich. I felt that his desperate desire for peace was no bluff. At Dunkirk, Hitler told his general staff exactly what he had told me in 1934. It was necessary that the great civilization Britain had brought to the world should continue to exist, and that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent. Hitler failed to comprehend the depravity of the behind-the-scenes figures of the world order who had gained control of the British Empire with the South Africa wealth they had won in the Boer War. This hoard of gold and diamonds represented the greatest influx of new purchasing power into Europe since the Spanish galleons brought in the gold of the Incas. The resistance encountered in this war caused the planners to resolve that in the future, wars would be managed as precisely as any other business operation. Their philosophy of Hegelian determinism called for setting up two opposing forces, thesis and antithesis, which would be thrown against each other in conflict to produce an outcome, synthesis. Between the two world wars, it was necessary to rearm Germany, and also to back a German government strong enough to prepare the nation for another war. The same people who had supplied Germany from 1916 to 1918 in order to keep World War I going backed the Nazis to produce a second world war. The Schröders and Rothschilds had set up Hoover with the Belgian Relief Commission, in partnership with Emil Francke, the Beast of the Congo, later the U.S. Food Administration, run by selfless men who inexplicably amassed sudden fortunes in sugar, grain and shipping. Two of these men, Prentice Gray and Julius H. Barnes, then became partners in Schröder Company. The New York Times Deck 11,1940 noted that Baron Bruno von Schröder died at his home here, Dell Park, Inglefield Green, Surrey. He came to England in 1900 and was naturalized in 1914. He established J. Henry Schröder & Company in London 1904 and in New York, 1923. His son Helmut W. B. Schröder now becomes head of the firm. His partner. 150. Frank Cyril Schierks has been a director of the Bank of England since 1912. In 1923, Baron von Schröder bought the Baghdad Railway. The deal was the biggest of under cover at the Lausanne Conference, disposing of former German concessions in Turkey, and the Rothschilds and Lloyds Bank shared with Baron Schröder in the syndicate that advanced $25 million to start the rebuilding of the lines. The importance of the Schröder firm between the two world wars is shown by the following excerpts, New York Times Deck 3, 1923, The first installment of capital for the new currency bank, which will grow out of the Rentenbank, was issued in Berlin today in the shape of checks in pounds sterling, to the value of 25 million gold marks, $6,250,000, from the London bankers Schroeder and Company, whose share in the capital loan is 100 million gold marks, $25 million. Baron Henry Schroeder, who is the head of the firm, has long been closely connected with German financial interests in the international field. New York Times, November 25, 1928, J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation Finance and Trade Commentary states, if, in the forthcoming reparations conference, the external obligations of Germany are fixed at some reasonable figure, it would be an important step in Germany's whole economic recovery. New York Times, November 2, 1928 J. Henry Schroeder Company floats a $10 million 6% loan to Prussian Electric Power Company in partnership with Brown Brothers Harriman. New York Times, November 1, 4, 1929. The Prussian state has arranged a $5 million loan from J. Henry Schroeder Company to extend Stettin in Harbor. New York Times, January 27, the City Company of New York and the J. Henry Schroeder Trust Company have been designated as German bond scrip agents by the Gold Discount Bank of Berlin. Representatives of Amerikanhauses official said yesterday that they were without direct advice from Berlin, where the Germans and representatives of other 151 creditors are now conferring. The bankers are represented there by John Foster Dulles of the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. New York Times, April 19, 1940. The J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation has succeeded Speyer and Company as fiscal and paying agent for City of Berlin 25 years 61 over 2% gold bonds due in 1950. A leading economist, Professor von Wiegand, has gone on record criticizing the present writer for statements about the Schroeder Company, claiming the firm had little or no connection with Germany, apparently, because he had not resorted to the subject in the New York Times. The president of J. Henry Schroeder also issued a denial in 1944 that they had done any business in Germany. Adolf Hitler had joined the German Workers' Party in 1919, because it was supported by the Thule Society, an influential German society of aristocrats and financiers. In 1921, Hitler met with Admiral Schroeder, commander of the German Marine Corps. In Deck 1931, the Circle of Friends was formed, 12 prominent German businessmen who promised to donate regularly to the Nazi Party. Baron Kurt von Schroeder, partner of J. H. Stein Company Cologne Bankers, was the leader of this group. J. H. Stein then became Hitler's personal banker. Hitler's aide, Walter Funk, met with Schroeder to discuss the real views of Hitler on questions concerning the international bankers. Funk was able to satisfy Schroeder, and the financial support of the Nazi Party continued. Major Winterbotham points out that Lord Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England for more than 30 years, was Hjalmar Schacht's best friend. Schacht, Hitler's finance minister, named his grandson Norman because of the friendship. Paul Einzig, in appeasement before, during and after the war, says on May 29, Mr. F.C. Shirks of the British banking delegation met with Dr. Schacht, and found Dr. Schacht's attitude wholly satisfactory. Mr. Shirks was a longtime partner of J. Henry Schroeder and director of the Bank of England, since 1912. His granddaughter married the present Duke of Bedford. 152. On P78, Einzig says, towards the end of 1936 a new firm was registered in London under the name of Compensation Brokers Limited, which was controlled by the banking house of J. Henry Schroeder and Company, and Hambrose Bank Limited, with the declared object of assisting with barter transactions between Germany and various parts of the English Empire. When Alfred Rosenberg came to London, he was introduced to many leading figures, including Geoffrey Dawson, editor of the Times, Walter Elliot MP, Lord Hailsham, Secretary for War, and the Duke of Kent, brother of King Edward VIII and George VI. The Duke of Coburg, a close friend of Hitler, had three long talks with King Edward VIII on his accession in January 1936. Edward assured the Duke of his sympathies with the Third Reich. In 1965, the then Duke of Windsor remarked, "I never thought Hitler was such a bad chapter." The story behind Edward's sudden abdication was that his advisors realized and he old not signifiable for mobilization against Germany. An American divorcee was brought into the picture. She led Edward off to the Rothschild Castle in Austria, while his slightly retarded brother George was installed as King of England. During the mid-30s, three isolationist groups were active in England: the Link, led by Admiral Sir Barry Domville, and composed of genuinely patriotic Englishmen; the Anglo-German Fellowship, organized by J. Henry Schroeder Company with the help of the Soviet Moltke Philby to lull Hitler into the belief that England would never declare war on him; and the Cliveden Set, who met at Lord Astor's palatial castle, Cliveden, to promote appeasement.